Welcome to the Mindfulness Podcast. This is David Black. My guest today is Dr. Zev Schumann Olivier. He is assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He's a board certified addiction psychiatrist, and he serves as director for addiction research at the Cambridge Health Alliance. His research focuses on the treatment of addictive disorders, the current emphasis on outpatient maintenance therapy for opioid use disorder. Welcome, Zev. Great to see you again.
David, it's great to see you. Thanks for having me.
So I read your new article. It tests the effect of a mindful recovery program on pain, anxiety, and substance use during office-based opioid treatment. This study is published in the American Journal on Addictions. What about your background led you to conduct this study?
It's a great question. I think I always wanted to understand the potential impacts that mindfulness could have for people in treatment with medications for opiate use disorder. I previously have worked for about 15 years as a buprenorphine prescriber, which is a medication for opiate use disorder, even kind of at the very beginning of the opioid crisis, and saw what a major issue this would become for our country. And felt that a lot of people could really benefit from medication, and at the same time might also benefit from meditation. And when I initially started to have that area of interest, people told me that this is back about 15 years ago, that people who were dealing with addiction or addictive disorders would not be able to practice mindfulness or meditate because saying that was the actual deficit that people had. And I really wanted to set out to prove that wrong, because I had known many people and you know, who had sustained recoveries through meditation and mindfulness, and want to understand how is mindfulness helping people have greater sense of self-control and reducing their impulsivity and helping them to deal with all the comorbidities or things that come along with substance use. And we had some, you know, specific ideas about that I can go into if you want to hear about it. But this study in particular was a pilot study, and with just 18 people who were enrolled receiving buprenorphine for opiate use disorder.
And, can I add to that? Yeah, here's where you get into your study method. And I wondered, your study had me wondering about office-based treatment just generally. I don't know the standard of care currently, like before the mindfulness element is added. What does office-based treatment like mean? What's the standard of care? What do people get?
Yeah.
What's the treatment plan moving forward typically?
So medications for opiate use disorder come in a few different types. There's methadone, which you might hear people refer to as methadone maintenance, which often happens at a specific clinic where people have to go in starting out daily and get dosed with the medication. And it's very helpful. And it was the original gold standard. And now it's primarily used for people with more severe opiate use disorder. And buprenorphine, which is a agonist-antagonist opioid medication, which means that it's a partial agonist, I should say. So what it means is that it only fills up the opioid receptors about halfway. So people don't really get a high feeling if they have opiate use disorder, but they also don't go into withdrawal. And then it has an antagonist that's often packaged with it, so that if people try to abuse it in any way, they get the antagonist, which means it'll put them into withdrawal. So there's less abuse potential with buprenorphine than there might be with some of the other opioid agonists or partial agonists. And then there's naltrexone, which is an extended released antagonist, which blocks the opioid receptor so that people can't get any kind of feelings of benefit from opioid use. So buprenorphine treatment is what we're talking about here. And basically it was established in 2004 that prescribers start to conduct opioid treatment in the office. And that started initially, actually, primarily with psychiatrists like myself. I'm a board certified addiction psychiatrist. And then around in the 2010s, you saw a much higher increase of primary care providers and addiction management providers starting to prescribe buprenorphine. And then basically in 2016, it was expanded to nurse practitioners and PAs prescribing. And so office-based opioid treatment means that people are prescribing in the office. You get a prescription, you take it to the pharmacy, you fill it, and you take the medication at home. And different programs have different lengths of time that people might get that. Sometimes people are required to do counseling with them. Sometimes they are not. Sometimes there's a nurse involved, as in our site, where we had addiction-trained nurses who do some medication monitoring for people. But the primary thing is that what we're talking about is buprenorphine treatment as an outpatient, with people getting prescriptions that they are taking at home. And generally, buprenorphine is taken as a sublingual medicine, or underneath the tongue, or dissolving as either a film or a tablet. And the idea is that when people take it, it prevents withdrawal, and it can prevent craving as well. And if people, because buprenorphine binds very tightly to the mu opioid receptors in the brain, if people use a full agonist like heroin or some fentanyls, it actually can get blocked by the buprenorphine as well. So it also reduces overdose risk substantially. So our goal is really to help people to stay on the buprenorphine, and then to look at whether or not when they're on the buprenorphine, if they have reductions in symptoms that might lead them to drop out of treatment. So that's one of the important things to say, is that staying in buprenorphine treatment, retention in treatment, is considered to be one of the important goals. When people stop their buprenorphine, the risk of overdose goes up. They lose their tolerance, and they're more sensitive and more likely to potentially overdose if they use illicit opioids. So we started this to think about what would it be like to be able to see if mindfulness could help people to remain engaged in buprenorphine treatment. And some of the things that cause people to drop out of buprenorphine treatment are things like cocaine use, comorbid psychiatric challenges, dual diagnosis, whether it be things like psychosis, bipolar disorder, anxiety disorders, depression. People actually tend to stay in treatment, so that is less of a risk. Sometimes people drop out because of pain, because they want to take more pain medication because they're in chronic pain, and the buprenorphine isn't covering it, the whole thing.
I see what you mean. And thank you for that very wonderful description, taking us through all these treatments. So important to know about the options out there. What is the, for your approach, what is the dosage? Is this a daily?
Of the medication?
Yes.
So doses can range from 2 milligrams to 24, even 32 milligrams now in some cases, because fentanyl is so potent that in order to effectively block it, you need higher doses of buprenorphine. But in general, most people in the study, I believe doses were between 12 and 24 milligrams.
And you said sublingual, is this once per day?
We generally encourage once per day. Some people like to split their dose, but I strongly encourage them to take it once a day. And there's lots of reasons why we can go into that. But if you're taking the medicine many times a day, then you're thinking about your opioid needs many times a day. It's better to take a larger dose and not go through many withdrawals throughout the day and be thinking about opioids, but to treat it like a morning vitamin and get opioids off your mind.
Excellent. And so if we're going to make the case here that something like a mindfulness recovery program could be useful, you're mentioning these barriers to continued medication use, and you mentioned maybe some comorbid mental health factors, some other types of drug use factors, mm-hmm. and so what's the picture of bridging what you see patients need with this daily medication regimen, because you're saying that keeping them adherent to the medication is most important. And so how does a program like your Mindful Recovery OUD care continuum work? That's what you named that program.
Right. So this is a trauma-informed program, and we try to create a motivationally sensitive curriculum. So for those that understand mindfulness-based interventions or MBIs, you understand that this is something that has that really has been needed, that early on when we started to bring mindfulness into opiate use disorder treatment back almost a decade ago, found two things happened. Either one, people got overwhelmed by the mindfulness and being asked to pay attention for a long period of time, or they didn't have confidence in themselves to think that they were someone who could do it, because gosh, they had opiate use disorder, they probably had ADD, and they had other types of traumatic experiences. And so we'd find that either people would give up early on, or they would be doing it and they'd finally get it at 8 weeks, which is the standard time for other mindfulness-based interventions. And then we'd say, okay, you're done. And they'd be like, whoa, I'm just getting this now. Now I'm ready to get started. So thinking about this as more of a chronic illness that really needed some with that has high risk potential, obviously with the potential for overdose if people drop out, that we really thought that a longer program where people could join for 4 weeks if they want to check it out and see what they think. We don't want to force anyone into mindfulness if it's going to be activating or triggering for them. But giving them that choice all along and then encouraging them to participate for a full 24 weeks. And so our goal was to see if we could get more people to stay in and feel confident with a 24-week approach. If we told them that, sign up for 4 weeks, you can stay up to 24 weeks. And I think that for those that participate, the vast majority do want to go for the 24 weeks once they start to have the experience. But so we start off with more of a low dose, with an orientation and then a low dose approach, where they learn some grounding techniques and they start to build up the capacity to practice. We had data from our spiritual self schema study, which is actually the first study of mindfulness with opiate use disorder. And that was back in 2004, 2005, when I was at Yale working with a team there. And we, what we did was we did what we called a, basically an increasing dose ladder and dose increasing practice ladder. And so people started out at 5 minutes a day of practice for a week and then would go up to 10 minutes a day. So we do that. We try to get people, encourage them to try to get up to 20 minutes a day over the first, 8 weeks, basically. And then if they are able to do that, then, you know, we suggest that they're in good shape for being able to move on to the more intensive part, which is adapted from the practices of a standardized mindfulness-based intervention. So in that way, we try to really focus on choice and making sure that they feel like they have control throughout the process. We teach things like the window of tolerance and let people know that they can, I should say, and we also have a big focus and try to be attentive to the fact that anybody who's in this program could have had traumatic events and needs to be able to adapt things as needed for themselves. So that's kind of the fundamental part of the curriculum. We also envisioned this potentially happening within primary care or other healthcare centers where people could finish this 6-month curriculum and then head into an ongoing mindfulness continuation group where they could do mindfulness check-ins and keep their practice going. But again, what we want to look at in this study was, is it feasible? Will it be acceptable? Will people go on to 24 weeks? And we have another paper that actually demonstrated that, that was published in Journal of Substance Abuse Treatment.
And what's the delivery of this program? Is this like one-to-one during office hour care or is this group-based?
So this is group-based. And we generally had in this study about six to eight people in groups. For the pilot study, we now are running a national live online trial comparing the mindful recovery opiate use disorder care continuum with group-based opiate treatment, which is like a live online recovery group. And we're in 16 states. And we actually just finished recruitment of, you know, what was it, 260 plus people into the study. And and people are basically what we're doing online now, for obviously because of COVID, we had to change, which is a whole nother story to get into of what it means to turn a big study like this around during COVID, when it's a group-based study. But we created live online groups, and people come online for 30 minutes. They do our toxicology screens and socialize with other folks on Zoom, and then they go into a 60-minute group, and they do that for 24 weeks. And the first 4 weeks are an orientation to the online profile, getting used to the group. We also use some motivational interviewing themes to try to build their sense of confidence and comfort and safety with doing mindfulness and being in a group. And then we go into the low dose mindfulness curriculum, and then into the more intensive program, which is based on our mindfulness training for primary care program, which has been shown in multiple studies to help people increase behavior change related to chronic illness. And so we adapted that to focus it specifically on opioid recovery. It involves both mindfulness and compassion-based approaches, and has threads throughout that bring in themes of behavior change, interpersonal mindfulness, as well as self-compassion, warmth into each session. And so that's the underlying structure that we use to build the intervention that we're talking about today.
Excellent. And in the pilot study, with the sample of 18 individuals, this design is within subject repeated measurement over time, which is, you know, what we classically would do early on in trials. What were the eligibility features of this sample? So we know kind of the people who would be enrolled in this type of paired treatment.
Sure. So we enrolled people who were adults, 18 or older, who were members of our primary care network, who had DSM-5 opiate use disorder, who had been on sublingual buprenorphine for at least 30 days. And I think that's important. It's really hard to really bring mindfulness into buprenorphine treatment, I think, before 30 days, because there's a lot of instability in those first 30 days as people are getting started on the medication. And there's not a lot of space to think about a lot of other things. So they had to speak English, and they had to be able to provide informed consent. If we thought they were going to be hospitalized in the next, 6 months, if they had marked cognitive deficits, we used the Montreal, cognitive assessment to be able to assess for that. If they couldn't complete baseline assessments or signs of severe mental illness that would have disrupted the group, then we had to exclude them.
Okay. And with the main outcomes measures, urine toxicology was very important for your group. We know we want the subjective assessment. At baseline, week 4 and 24, there were some other completion of self-report like pain and anxiety. Anything else about those measures? Which measure was most relevant for what you were trying to detect? And what did you find for the result?
Right. So we wanted to see the impacts on comorbidities that we knew impacted people's ability to be successful in buprenorphine treatment long-term. So the first one is cocaine. So, remember this study happened in 2018, before COVID. And, even as it was ending, one of the things that really was starting was the comorbidity of methamphetamine with opiate use disorder, which is kind of like the fourth wave now. But cocaine was the stimulant that people were using mostly at that time. And it's been well known that when people were using stimulants, abusing stimulants like cocaine or now methamphetamine with opiate disorder, they're more likely to drop out of care by 6 months. And so we wanted to see whether or not cocaine use would reduce while people were in opiate use treatment with mindfulness. Another reason why people drop out or end up getting kicked out of care or causes difficulties in care is because people end up using benzodiazepines to manage their anxiety or their affect, their emotional dysregulation. And so we wanted to see whether or not mindfulness could help reduce benzodiazepine use, and the reason why it causes problems is because benzodiazepines can impact memory. People can have, our previous data showed that people have more accidental injuries and ED visits when they mix benzodiazepines with buprenorphine. But the biggest thing is that people sometimes tend to use more benzodiazepines and need more over time. And that ends up causing a lot of problems with being able to stay in addiction treatment. And a lot of addiction providers have a lot of concerns about benzodiazepines. We wanted to see whether or not, that could be impacted. And actually we did find that both cocaine and benzodiazepines decreased over time in this sample of patients who were in buprenorphine treatment. The other thing we wanted to see is that, again, people drop out sometimes because of anxiety and because because of comorbid psychiatric symptoms. So we did find that among people that had anxiety at baseline, that there was a significant decrease in their anxiety levels. And then finally, pain can really interfere with people's life. And pain is a reason why people relapse, because the buprenorphine helps them with pain a fair amount, but doesn't take it all away. And if people are used to turning to opioids for pain relief, sometimes when people have chronic pain or it's interfering with their life, they'll return again to pain medications. And that can be a reason for relapse or for getting kicked out of their program. So what we found was that the mindfulness program and people who are in this 24-week program with mindfulness and buprenorphine actually had reduced pain over the course of 24 weeks. And that about 58% of people who are basically people who had chronic pain used pain to reduce pain catastrophizing and rumination. So they stopped worrying about the pain as much, and they didn't catastrophize or think, they didn't allow their mind to make the pain worse than what it was. And one of the ways they did that, we think is because mindfulness helped to reduce experiential avoidance. Experiential avoidance is this idea that when things are unpleasant or uncomfortable in our experience, we tend to want to avoid that. And one of the things that mindfulness and acceptance-based interventions do is help people to turn towards it and to learn how to be with it. Or as we say in our program, helping people to learn how to warmly be with the unpleasant experience.
And that's an important piece, especially I think this finding. Did you want to speak anything more about that measurement from 0 to 4 weeks? Because is the advantage beyond, because I know this is a pilot, do you believe the advantage is beyond what the medication was already improving from 0 to 4, and you found additional?
So people were all already stable on medication for at least 30 days before they started. So we wanted to look at 4 weeks to see, low dose mindfulness is something a lot of people are getting, and maybe is that enough? And so we actually checked in with people at 4 weeks, and there was a lot of enthusiasm at 4 weeks. There was a sense that something was changing and that something was helpful to them, but there were no changes in cocaine use, benzo use, anxiety, or pain on the measures that we were looking at until you get out to 24 weeks. We didn't do 12-week assessments in this study. We will have them in the larger randomized controlled trial that's being conducted right now. I do think that this change in experiential avoidance, reductions in that experiential avoidance, which were significant at 24 weeks, increases in mindfulness, increases in interoceptive awareness, people's ability to feel internal body cues, and to be less reactive to them, and their ability to have self-compassion, be less self-critical, less hard on themselves, also seem to be very helpful, both for reducing stigma and internalized stigma and shame, but also self-criticism. And one of the things that can happen is when people are in recovery, early recovery, and they do have a slip, which is almost inevitable, they can start making these global attributions, which are that, I'm terrible. I'm never going to do this. Why did I even start trying? I can't do anything. These kinds of thoughts are very common. And so self-compassion can be something that can actually stop or break that kind of habit. And they can learn how to instead to be kind to themselves and then to give themselves what they really need, which is not more substance use or more, self-criticism, but is self-kindness.
And so as a final question to you, what do you find most promising about this preliminary work for addiction care moving forward?
Well, since we started this project and since I started doing this work back about a decade ago, nearly every single rehab place that I know of is now offering mindfulness. Nearly every addiction clinic is thinking about or talking about mindfulness in some context. I think one of the things that we're showing here is that the full dose of mindfulness is impactful. I think there's a lot of work to be done to understand what dose might be necessary for people to really have the kind of transformative change that helps them to sustain recovery. I think I'm really excited about our RCT and the results that are going to be coming out this fall to be able to understand some of the mechanisms involved in how mindfulness helps with this kind of behavior change and recovery. I think that we know now that it's acceptable, that it's feasible. It's not for everyone, and no one should be forced to practice mindfulness. And in fact, it will backfire if we try to force people. It'll just activate the trauma and other things that people have. But a trauma-informed approach that's motivationally sensitive can be helpful. And I think this basically suggests that this is a viable alternative, whether or not it's better or not than other interventions that we see, like CBT or relapse prevention. I think the jury's out. That's why we're doing these studies, to try to understand. But clearly the group environment with non-judgmental group environment with these supportive practices are having an impact for people. They're appreciating it. We're seeing engagement with the expected mechanisms that we would see. And people are feeling like it's changing their lives. And I think ultimately that's what it's about. The medication can help keep people from overdosing. We want to help people have a life that's worth living and that they feel that they can look in the mirror and feel good about who they are. And it's actually a paper that we have as well that I'll point people to that was published in Frontiers in Psychology that's titled "Today I Can Look in the Mirror and Like Myself." And I think that speaks to the power of mindfulness and self-compassion for people in early recovery.
Well, thank you, Zev, for your very thoughtful responses today. It was wonderful seeing and talking to you once again. I hope you have a lot of success with your work, very important work, helping people recover. And listeners can subscribe to the Mindfulness Podcast at Spotify and Audible.